Love the Beach Boys. Welcome back. You're listening to Tad Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. What's the thinking, Deb? We're heading into cold weather and you play the Beach Boys?
We've got to. It's coming.
Well, I think there's a bit of a theme crossover with our first guest. Please join me in welcoming Carolyn Nishon. How are you, Carolyn?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I've never been happier. Carolyn is the executive director of the Portland Symphony Orchestra. God, you know what? I've got such a problem with names. Not necessarily Carolyn, but have you ever heard the Brian Regan comedy special talking about Carolyn, Caroline?
Oh, no. I'll have to check that out.
I know. Do you ever get called Caroline?
Oh, constantly.
Yeah. He does this whole special where he's like, I've got this friend. I call her Caroline. She says it's Carolyn, and his name's Brian Regan. He goes, my name's Brian. And it's something where, but it's Carolyn.
It is Carolyn because, you know, Caroline is spelled L-I-N-E.
Like I know, that's what you would think. You would think, but somehow they're both wonderful names, but we'll go with yours.
Great, thanks.
I'm really interested in what's going on with the PSO, and I think that there's a long history here in Maine and in Portland. But before we get there, why don't we talk a little bit about your background that led you to the executive director, and then we'll talk about what the executive director does. We'll lobby to see if I can play in the symphony, not that I have any kind of musical talent, and then we'll talk about what's going on the upcoming season.
That sounds great.
So how do you end up being the executive director? Where you went to school, and did you grow up thinking, boy, I want to be the executive director of an orchestra?
Yeah, so when I was young, my mother was a piano teacher. So
you're still young. We've got to stop this right here.
Everyone in the building
compared to me is young, so you're making me feel bad. So yeah, you are definitely young.
When I was a child, my mother is a piano teacher, and she grew up, I had music around the house all the time. I started playing piano when I was six. I joined my fifth grade strings program in the public schools when I was 10. And so music was always a part of my life growing up. And I went through all elementary school playing, all of middle school, playing violin in an orchestra, and then through high school as well. And I found that I made my closest friends, had my greatest connections through my high school orchestra. I had a really incredible public music program through the school.
And where was that you grew up?
That is Okemos High School and the Okemos Public School Systems in Michigan.
Oh, wow. What part of Michigan is that?
It's mid-Michigan, so it's near East Lansing where Michigan State University is.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So I knew I loved music. It was a huge part of my life. All of my research papers in high school ended up being about music somehow. And I knew I wanted it to be a part of my life. But
All classical, or were you into Bob Seger and Kid Rock at all?
Many different types
Many
of music.
Many different things.
Yeah. But there was just something about being able to make music with my friends as a part of something larger. So I went to college, but I knew I didn't want to major in music. And I was trying to figure out how I kept it a part of my life. And so when I first got to college, I ended up being an English and psychology major.
Wow.
But I started playing in an orchestra that was generally for people who were wanting to continue playing but didn't necessarily major in music. It was called the Michigan Pops Orchestra. And it was a group of probably about 100 students in the university that just wanted to keep playing. And you take a look at our Portland Symphony, the Pop series now, where we have themed concerts, where we're featuring different types of music. That's actually exactly what this was. So each semester, we had a theme for our concerts. And a team of students was not only playing in the orchestra, but running the orchestra. So there was an executive director, publicity director, treasurer, librarian. And that's how I got really involved in the management side of orchestras was in college.
So you really kind of integrated your musical interest with kind of the running and the detail. And
exactly.
By the way, before we get too far, what is POPS? I mean, relative to in the case of the Portland Symphony Orchestra, which we'll be talking about, very, you know, I grew up outside of Boston and it was always Arthur Fiedler and the POPS.
Yeah.
And for many people, obviously Deb knows because she's cultured in this area, right, Deb?
Oh, of course.
You know what POPS is versus the orchestra and traditional
stuff. I should because I was in music for many years, but I do not.
You do not?
Mm.
So why don't you explain just, and then we'll get back to kind of your trajectory, but what is technically when you hear that an orchestra is POPS, does it delineate versus your traditional orchestra?
Sure. So the Portland Symphony has a number of different series. We have our classical series where we are performing on Tuesdays and on Sundays, and generally you will find us performing Beethoven, Brahms, Tchaikovsky.
The classics.
Classics, and you know, many composers that are composing today. But on our pop series, you will find, like we're doing this season, tributes to John Denver, the Beach Boys, a feature on Portland in Love. So great classical hits that are focused on love, but also popular tunes as well. You might hear some Frank Sinatra, that type of thing.
But it can be, and many times is, the same orchestra.
That's right.
It's just the selection is more contemporary music stylized through the orchestra and the arrangements in the orchestra.
That's right. So sometimes it is a series within one orchestra. And sometimes, like you mentioned with the Boston Pops is its own orchestra. So for the Portland Symphony, this PSO Pops series is one of the lines of tickets that we offer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that clears that up, Deb, right?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Now back to you. We have we have Carolyn, not Caroline, Carolyn Nishon here. So from Michigan and from your experience getting involved, where do you go from there and how did you end up here in Maine?
Yep. So my senior year, while I was running the Michigan Pops Orchestra, I started interning at the Ann Arbor Symphony. And then after that, a friend of mine, as I was looking to what happens next after I graduate, she sent me this link to a fellowship. And at the time, it was through the League of American Orchestras. And the fellowship was for people who were interested in becoming orchestra managers, getting in-depth experience, real hands-on experience in the field. And so I applied, basically went through an apprentice-style interview where there were about 13 finalists that went to New York, and it got narrowed down to five. And those five of us ended up getting to work with four different organizations, arts organizations and orchestras.
And what was the criteria? Was it more on the business side or the marketing, or was it more on the musical side and understanding the kind of the structure of an orchestra?
I would say both. So actually, at the time, I had no professional experience.
Wow.
They were looking for someone who they could see having the potential to grow into a management role within an orchestra. And there were a number of people that did have some experience in the field already, but I was pretty green. And what was so incredible about the program was I got to work with these four different organizations, the Aspen Music Festival and School, the North Carolina Symphony, the Spokane Symphony in Washington, and the Baltimore Symphony in Maryland, in that order. So I ping-ponged back and forth across the country. But I got to work with the staff members, the musicians, and the trustees of each of these orchestras and got to really understand how they ran, got to meet some amazing artists. And coming from just a college setting where I had no contacts in the field to all of the sudden having this really incredible network, not only of the orchestras that I worked with, but of the four other fellows that went through the program. They actually were in different orchestras from me. We all started in the Aspen Music Festival and School together, and then we all went our separate ways.
What?
But in between each of the sessions that were about 3 months each, 3 to 4 months each, we would all meet in New York City, and we would meet with leaders in the field and have special training from them, too.
What an interesting program.
Yeah.
I may have just stayed in Aspen. Wasn't Aspen great?
It was amazing. And we were there during the summer, too.
Oh.
And it was just perfect. I lived up in Snowmass, and it's just kind of up the mountain next door.
Right, right, right.
And the 40-minute drive down to Aspen was the most gorgeous drive every day.
Yeah, it used to be a place called, I think it was the Wheeler Theater in Aspen.
Yeah, it's still there.
It's still there?
Well, it was there when I was there, and we actually performed operas in there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Back in, boy, I don't even want to say, I mean, you were talking about, when you were young, when I was young. This was in the 70s, and I was touring around with the amazing Kreskin, and he used to play every year at the Wheeler Theater.
Yeah.
It was like the greatest gig. We stayed right downtown in Aspen.
Fine.
Yeah, but the other places sound nice, but I may have wanted to just say, hey, I'm not leaving. I'm not doing the rotation. I'm just kind of staying here.
The Portland Symphony, we just did our first Pops concert, tribute to John Denver, and I hadn't listened to a ton of John Denver
Rocky Mountain High,
and it was one of those things, I can't stop listening to John Denver
Wow.
after that concert, but listening to Rocky Mountain High, it totally brought me back to that first time when I drove into Colorado, because I had never really road tripped much with my family as a kid, and we drove from Michigan to Aspen, and it captured it perfectly.
Yeah, I haven't been to Aspen for a couple of years, but a month or two ago I was in Denver, and then I drove to Cheyenne, Wyoming, which is, you know, that's how you get to Cheyenne. You fly into Denver and you drive about an hour. But the Rocky Mountains and that area of the world is such a unique place. It's just, and for anyone listening that hasn't been out there and you have some time on your hands, go out. It's just that's one of the interesting things about America is we kind of divert into American travel here. We think of the U.S. as being kind of homogenous because it's, but so many areas are so distinctive. In talking about Colorado and the mountains in Colorado and Aspen, that's certainly one. So after you did the rotation, how did that transition to being, you coming here to Portland, or was there another step?
Yeah, so I had mentioned those kind of brief stints in New York in between the assignments. And at that time, when we met in New York, I met one of the leaders in the field. His name was Ari Solotoff, and he, at the time, was the Portland Symphony Orchestra's executive director. So when it came time at the end of the fellowship year, all five of us were trying to find our next step in our job, and that was something we had to do on our own. And during college, when I was at the University of Michigan, I actually did this program through the English department called the New England Literature Program. It was a program for about 2 months in the summer. It was a program that was focused on New England writers and poets. No technology. So about 30 students from U of M drove to Maine from Michigan and lived on Sebago for that time. And I fell in love with Maine. And so fast forward a couple of years and I'm...
Why Sebago? Is that like our Walden's Pond? Is that where the inspiration would come from, poets and dreamers?
Well, there's a camp called Wohelo on Lake Sebago.
Deb, can you spell that, please?
I know.
Can we Google search?
Wohelo.
Wow.
And so that was my first experience, really, with New England. We would read and write, and we went hiking. We hiked Mount Washington. We did Franconia. And I had never done any of this before. And for that first time, it was in the spring, so kind of waking up in those cold spring mornings and smelling the pitch pines, that's something I hadn't experienced before. So fast forward a couple of years later, and I'm sitting in my apartment in Baltimore that I had found on Craigslist because I had to find a new place to live every 4 months, and I see this job, and it's based in Portland, Maine, the place where I had met Ari Solotoff, knew he worked there,
and Ari was still there.
Still there.
Because, so you pushed him out. You came here and it was like, I'm kidding.
So I saw it and I remember pulling up Google Maps because I wanted to see how close Portland, Maine, which I had never heard of before, how close it was to this place called Camp Wohelo. And I pulled it up and it was 35 minutes away and I couldn't believe it because this place where I had driven out to had no cell phone, no iPod, nothing at the time. It just seemed completely otherworldly, and to be able to make the connection and to think that I might be able to move near or back to that place was incredible.
Wow.
So at the national conference, which actually was that year in Denver, I applied for the job and got it, but it was it was called Artistic Administrator and Orchestra Manager. So at the time, it was much more focused on logistics, on organizing the season, on really behind-the-scenes work with the players, with the operations team, everything that goes on that you would never really know was going on before you get into a hall and see an orchestra perform. And my role with the symphony has evolved over the last 7 or so years. It evolved from orchestra manager to director of artistic operations, in more recent years, general manager. And then there was a leadership change in executive directors from Ari Solotoff to Lisa Dixon French. She was here for 5 years, and her husband got an incredible opportunity to go to Nashville. So they recently moved, and then the orchestra launched into a full national search for the executive director position, and I applied.
Wow.
Yep.
That's a great story. Yeah. And the other thing that the three most recent leaders, the executive directors of the Portland Symphony Orchestra, by the way, we have Carolyn Nishon here. all have such artistic orchestra-like names. Between Ari, and how do you pronounce his
Ari.
Name? Ari.
Solotov, yeah.
And then the woman who held
it. Lisa Dixon French.
Lisa Dixon French, and then we have Carolyn Nisha. There's no Bob Miller. There would be, I would be disqualified. Steve Woods would just be too pedestrian. Yeah. It all sounds artistic and, you know. All that.
Yeah, and actually all three of us went through that same fellowship program.
And is that still active now?
It's changed since. But the thing that I really loved about it was just how experiential it was and the way that it created a network so quickly. It was really incredible.
Yeah, and it brought people from different cities, from different areas all together, and it worked out great. So that started in 2008, is that right, when you were started with here in Portland?
That's right.
The other thing we have in common, other than my non-musical talent, and obviously your musical talent is, I did time in Michigan also.
Oh, really?
You did time?
What did you do in Michigan?
I was a young marketing exec, and I got a call from Coca-Cola USA, and they're like, we want to put you in our executive program, and you're going to get a company car, and you're going to have an assistant, and all that's the good news. And I was like, oh, what's the bad news? And again, this isn't my sentiment. This came from the HR person at Co. Well, the office is in Dearborn, Michigan, and I was in Boston at the time, which I thought was a nice place. I mean, Michigan and Detroit area particularly has gone through some hardship in the last few decades, but it lived in Farmington Hills.
Yeah,
and
HR person wasn't doing their organization.
They weren't.
Too,
well, you know, everyone likes to rag on Detroit, but Michigan itself, there's a Michigan that's absolutely beautiful.
Oh, yeah. My whole family's still in Michigan.
Yeah. It's stunning. If, in, you know, when you hold up the hand, you go, where are you
on
the
exactly
thumb?
Right.
And where?
I'm here.
Yeah. And if you're down on the, you know, Detroit and Dearborn is still going through some rough times in terms of the auto industry and kind of the economy collapsing, but, Michigan itself has played a huge role in terms of both the Industrial Revolution and other key areas in our country. So there's no ragging on Michigan here, Deb.
No.
None.
No.
Okay, so now we've brought everyone up to speed. You've got here in 2008. Sooner or later, you push Ari out of the picture. You moved in. I'm kidding. You became general manager and then executive director in this last year. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about I want to understand the role of executive director, and then I also want to understand, for listeners that may not be familiar, what is the Portland Symphony Orchestra? How is it structured? How many members? Mm-hmm. How are the economics work? And are there tryouts and all that? But let's start with your role, executive director. What is your day-to-day role? And then we'll talk about what is the Portland Symphony Orchestra.
Sure. I have been on the job now almost to the day, 2 months.
Okay.
And I will say that every single day has been entirely different from the last. My role, so there is a board of trustees. We're a nonprofit organization. There is a board of trustees. We have a board of about 30. And the board is tasked with hiring both the executive director and the music director. Our music director is Robert Moody. So Robert, his area of the organization, he focuses on the artistic piece, on conducting the musicians, on rehearsing with the musicians, making sure that he is the key artistic voice of what goes out into the community. I, as the executive director, I am the key liaison to the trustees, and I also oversee a staff of about 17 people. Within that staff, we have multiple different departments. We have our marketing department, so they are the people that are taking care of tickets and ticket sales. We have our development staff, and they are the individuals that are taking care of cultivating relationships in the community and asking for contributions to the symphony. We have our finance department that makes sure that everyone is keeping on task. Our operations team, we are not only the people that are backstage organizing all of the details for a season, we're also the ones that spend all of the money. Then we have our education team. And they are the individuals that go out into the community, that build on the programs that we're putting on for our concerts. We provide youth concerts for fourth and fifth graders. We put on discovery concerts for families. We have kinder concerts, which are small ensembles of musicians that go all around the state to perform. So that those are the different branches of the staff that I oversee.
Interesting. So, yeah. So at the Portland Symphony Orchestra, other than the trustees, which are kind of the board of directors, yes. The two key functions are the music, the Robert Moody, who heads up the music artistic part.
That's right.
And you oversee the operations and administrative.
That's correct.
How do the economics work in mm-hmm. being a nonprofit and, you know, we were talking about this.
I didn't realize it was a nonprofit.
It is a nonprofit. Yep.
So
and that's a common misconception, actually.
Is the goal and does it operate as a nonprofit mm-hmm. to end up at the end of the season at a zero sum
mm-hmm.
or
yep.
it's not designed to raise money for educational programs? It's designed really to be self-sustaining in terms of the orchestra itself?
I would say both. We do raise money for our educational programs, but each year as we begin our budgeting process, we start from the ground up and we budget our expenses and ensure that what we believe that we can bring in from contributions and ticket sales, grants, foundations,
yeah.
That it comes to a balanced budget.
And yeah. for the musical part, and I yes. know this isn't your day-to-day part, this is Robert Moody's, but how many people are actually playing in the orchestra mm-hmm. in relative to the Portland Symphony Orchestra versus others? Is it a static number
mm-hmm.
or do different orchestras say, no, we need an extra flute? We need, you know, now we need more cowbell, so we're adding that, you know.
Yeah.
So how many people and how do they sustain themselves?
Sure.
And how does the pay work for that?
Absolutely. So each orchestra across the country is unique in its structure.
Okay.
This orchestra, the Portland Symphony Orchestra, operates on about a $3.3 million operating budget. In contrast, the Boston Symphony, I don't know the exact number, I would guess maybe upwards of $90 to $100 million a
wow.
year. So for a Boston Symphony musician, someone who has won a position with the Boston Symphony, and you mentioned tryouts, or we call them
right.
auditions, I can talk a little bit about that. They can sustain themselves. They can have their entire living as a Boston Symphony musician on their Boston musician salary. For the Portland Symphony Orchestra, we are what is called a per-service orchestra. That means that every time a musician sits down and plays a rehearsal or plays a concert, they get a certain wage.
That's the service, yeah.
That's right. And for many of our musicians, they are on the road constantly looking to piece together their living. It's a very challenging life that they dedicate themselves to their art. So many of our musicians, while they have won a position with the Portland Symphony, are also playing in the Rhode Island Philharmonic. They're playing down in Boston. Some of them are playing in Vermont. Many of them are teachers in the area. Some of them are professors at USM. And they pull together their living in that way because the Portland Symphony on its own cannot sustain their full salary.
And how many musicians do make up the orchestra now?
There are 83 musicians that have won positions in the Portland Symphony, and that is outlined. We have we are a unionized organization. We're unionized through the Boston Musicians Association, so actually the same union that oversees the Boston Symphony oversees the Portland Symphony Orchestra. But we have a contract with them, and we have a certain number of positions that we have to fill. But like you mentioned, if there's a requirement for more cowbell,
right.
we hire additional musicians. So, for example,
because that's important, that cowbell.
Well, it can be.
Yeah. So we're doing a concert on November 10, and it includes the David Del Tredici and Alice Symphony. That piece, it calls for something like 26 different percussion instruments. Now, multiple percussion instruments can be played by one person, but we need many more percussionists on stage than our kind of core roster.
Right.
We actually also, in that piece, it calls for a theremin. Do you know what a theremin is?
Good trivia question. I've never even, it sounds like a cold medicine. Like, I need to take theremin. But,
yeah.
but no, I do not
It's know. Kind of, it. You might hear it in kind of spooky Halloween type. It's based on electricity and airwaves. I don't know how the whole thing is put together, but
right.
we need a percussionist to run, basically play the theremin. If you heard it, you would recognize the sound. But there are unique, each piece that's programmed has a unique, what we call an instrumentation that's required. So for some pieces that were written, no piccolo is needed, but for some, a theremin
is
needed.
I love the piccolo.
And so we have to take a look at, as we're budgeting and as we put the entire season together, how many people does each program require? As I mentioned, because each
right.
musician is per service, the more people on stage, the more the program's going to cost.
And again, I don't want to get too into the nitty-gritty
sure.
details, but there are some, and I have great respect for anyone with musical talent, and but when you listen to music, and particularly classical music, it feels like there are some instruments in some sections of different arrangements where there's an impossibly high skill level,
yep.
You know, particularly string and violin, mm-hmm. where it is in piano, where you can literally key on that. And then sometimes there's somebody off to the side named Freddie, and he has either a tambourine or a finger cymbal, and does the violinist playing the Stradivarius get the same pay as Freddie with the cymbal? And how do those economics work? Because they're all on stage. They're all represented by the union. And I just don't think Freddie should get the same amount as the violinist who is, you know, their fingers are bleeding and they're doing unbelievable things.
I will say, when I think of our orchestra.
They're all good, I'm sure.
They're all great technicians. And in many ways, I see them as athletes. They have been training for years and years and years. They go through, you know, college, and then they get into grad school, and then you mentioned these tryouts. They have to take these auditions. And for any given audition that we may hold, we have at least 40 people auditioning for that one spot. And oftentimes, across the country, the general practice is a screen will be put between the panel and the people auditioning. We lay down a carpet, so if women are wearing heels, you can't hear their heels. And they will, there is a set number of pieces that we ask them to perform in advance, and there are a whole host of them. And then that day, we will choose of that larger selection which ones we would like them to play.
Purely based on musical performance.
Correct.
It's a little bit like The Voice on TV, where they do the blind audition,
absolutely.
And you take away the aesthetic, and you take away any other bias.
It is about their artistic abilities and sensibilities. And so while you might see someone with, you know, a cymbal, you know, or a tambourine in their hand, they are so precise in the absolute exact second that they play that tambourine, that each note that they play is given with the same care as you might see a violinist, you know, playing 20, 30, 40, 100 notes. You did ask about different pay structure, though. So in the same way that you might have a team leader in an orchestra, we have something similar. So there are many teams within the orchestra. There are strings. They each have their principals. There are winds and brass. They each have their principals, their leaders. Those leaders are paid at a different rate from the individuals in their section.
Yeah.
And that's very standard across the industry.
And how about the leader of the orchestra?
Mm-hmm.
This is both my bias and probably my ignorance, because I love classical music. I've always wondered with the leader, the
conductor,
the conductor, the guy with the baton.
Yep.
Because half the time it doesn't feel as though all the members of the orchestra are looking up at he or she.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a great episode of Seinfeld where Elaine was dating this guy who was like the conductor
at
high school.
Yeah.
he was a conductor at like an assisted living facility or something. And he demanded to always be referred as the maestro.
Yes.
And so it was like anything else on Seinfeld, it was amplified and kind of a character. But it was just, he carried his baton, and wherever she introduced him, it would be like, I want to introduce you to, and once she said Fred or Bob, and he said, I am the maestro. So talk a little bit, and again, this is in no way diminishing the skill or the artistry or the commitment that conductors put into their field. But for the layman, explain a little bit how critical that role is in terms of keeping all the different parts of the orchestra literally and figuratively on the same page.
Yeah.
And if all the animated gestures really impact the sound,
mm-hmm.
or if it is just kind of part of the theater of orchestra.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a question that comes up quite a lot.
And you also mentioned who is the conductor for the orchestra.
So our music director, his name is Robert Moody. He has been with the symphony. Actually, we both had the same first concert at the same time. We both officially started with the orchestra in 2008, and he will be here through the 2017-2018 season. So we are so lucky that he will be here for a full 10-year tenure. But Robert, so in any situation, a conductor's goal is to know what we call the score. So essentially every piece of music that's on every person's stand in the orchestra, it's all listed out, kind of vertically stacked, every person's piece of music. He or she needs to know that score inside out. And then the role of the conductor is to interpret that score, to think about and translate with his or her body how that should be expressed or played, how a phrase grows in a piece of music, how the dynamics, the loud or soft parts, how
and
they evolve.
If their movements are kind of soft and fluid, then people are supposed to look up and kind of get the sense. And when they get more animated, that means the music has to be more, pronounced or with more kind of energy into each section.
Exactly. So the conductor is conveying the way in which the group stays together, encourages people to listen in certain ways, and also the way in which the piece is played should be a reflection of what his or her body is doing.
Right.
And I mentioned these leaders within the orchestra. The leaders within the orchestra, so say your concertmaster, which is your first chair, first violin, is picking up on the cues from the music director, the conductor. And also that person is sending back through body cues, through the way he or she is playing, the way to interpret that music. And that gets sent back in a ripple effect all the way through the orchestra.
So the whole orchestra is connected between the conductor and the first chair. And very interesting.
Yep.
Did you guys play at the Don McLean 4th of July?
We did.
And
we
was
did.
Robert Moody the conductor that
he
day?
He was.
Excellent. I went to that event. And what a wonderful event. First of all, I was a fan of Don McLean, not just his kind of iconic hit American Pie. But the orchestra just sounded really great that night up on the hill out on the prom.
Yeah, it means so much for us to be able to play on that 4th of July concert. Just being able to look out and see 60,000 people that live in your community and state and probably region and be able to share not only the music, but I mean, look behind you, the beautiful state of Maine. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, we have Carolyn Nishon here. She's the executive director of the Portland Symphony Orchestra. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 13:10 a.m. Before I forget, the website, anyone interested in more information, and you know, their shows sell out so quickly, so I don't even know if anything's available, but go to portlandsymphony.org. Facebook is facebook.com/Portland Symphony. And you guys are digital active. So on Twitter, PORTSYM. Talk a little bit about the upcoming season.
Sure.
And what is available for tickets and how people can participate either as sponsors or going to the shows. And let people know what's coming up at the Portland Symphony Orchestra.
Absolutely. So we are right now actually in the second year of what we're calling our Beethoven cycle. We are performing all 9 Beethoven symphonies, 1 music director, 1 orchestra, all 9 Beethoven symphonies.
Wow.
So we've been doing 3 each year. We did 3 symphonies of Beethoven's last year. We're going to be doing 3 this year. And that's something I really encourage any person interested in music to go to. Beethoven is just... He is kind of one of the key players in orchestral writing and just incredibly beautiful music. So I highly encourage you to check out those Beethoven symphonies that we are performing this year. We're doing 1, 5, and 8. So many people know Beethoven's 5th symphony. So I would highly recommend checking out those performances. In addition, actually, there's a concert coming up on November 10 that I had mentioned. And this is an interesting collaboration. We love collaborating with other community arts organizations. This is a collaboration with the Portland Ballet Company, and it's a celebration of Alice in Wonderland, actually. It's the 150th anniversary of that story being written, and we are working with Portland Ballet Company. They are doing choreography to a piece called An Alice Symphony by David Del Tredici. He is a living composer, and they will be dancing to many stories from Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. And the really cool part I love about this program is that actually the costumes that are being made for the Portland Ballet Company are being made by Maine College of Arts students. So they've developed a class around developing these costumes. And their entire course is about understanding what it means to be a dancer and how you can design for that with the music. And then meeting with them multiple times and seeing it culminate their work on stage with the Portland Symphony and the Portland Ballet Company.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Yeah. Not only are the music is kind of Maine-based with the Portland Symphony, but you have the ballet and then you have the costumes, very Maine-centric.
Yes. And so those are a couple of highlights on our classical series. I mentioned the pop series with Beach Boys and Portland in Love. We're closing our pop series with music of John Williams, which is quite timely with the new Star Wars movie coming out.
Yeah, people should be familiar with the...
don't know if you know that movie, Star Wars.
Yeah, it was a small movie. But what was it in the original Star Wars? It's like the thematic, iconic theme. What was it called? Is it just Star Wars theme?
The main title.
Main title music?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But I don't know. I think Star Wars was the original, and I'm sure the new one's going to be great. But that music was one of the first times you could recognize just classical, in-depth music playing a real role in a movie. And John Williams, he scored a lot of movies, but it was one of the first times where music wasn't just kind of in the background, where it was like it came right out of the foreground, right out of the screen, and it was just powerful.
Yeah. So we're looking forward to those concerts. The John Williams Pops concerts are April 23rd and 24th. As always, Magic of Christmas, they are our big holiday concerts, huge celebration of music in Maine, and we're actually going to be bringing Cirque de la Symphony to perform with us. They are, you may be familiar with Cirque du Soleil.
Oh, of course.
So we are going to have acrobats and jugglers and contortionists that are performing as the music takes place behind them.
Wow.
So we are really looking forward to that. And that is in December. We do 12 performances of that. And I had mentioned also our Discovery concerts that we do. And that is really focused on bringing families in to the Portland to experience the Portland Symphony and experience Merrill Auditorium for a reasonable price. So the tickets are only $10. And, you know, that's basically as much as a movie ticket, if not less. So we are able to provide a live concert experience. And we just had our first of the year. We did a trick-or-treat symphony. So Merrill Auditorium was filled with kids and parents and grandparents wearing Halloween costumes. We had a Count Dracula come out of a coffin and narrate a piece with orchestra. Our second concert, Family Discovery concert, is in February, called Once Upon a Time. And that actually also features the Portland Ballet. And it's about great storytelling. And then on May 15, we're doing a discovery concert for families called Beethoven Loves Nature. And it's actually really a deep dive into Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, but it's narrated by a puppet. And it's a leopard. But the puppeteer actually, I believe, trained and worked closely with Jim Henson.
Wow.
So we're
really
excited about that.
The Muppet creator. Wow. Back to the Cirque du Soleil style thing. Few people know this, but Deb is an accomplished gymnast.
Wow.
And yes.
That's fun.
Yeah. Are there open auditions? Because Deb does a tumbling thing that I don't know. I think it could really go nice.
It's a dream of mine to be up there with the PSO.
Oh. Yeah, PSO. We'll talk about that later. By the way, we have Carolyn Nishon here. She's the executive director of the Portland Symphony Orchestra. So you have a lot going on.
Mm-hmm.
So over the course of a year, how do you define season? Is there a start and end of the season, or does the symphony virtually go year round and there's just different segments?
Yeah, so we have our what we call internally kind of our regular season in the same way that a sports team would. And that runs from generally end of September through May or June. We're going through June this year. And then we have really been looking to be out in the summer more. So you saw us on the Eastern Promenade when Don McLean performed with us. This most recent year we were performing with Melissa Manchester. And that is possible through the July 4th Foundation that we're able to participate in that community and statewide celebration. This last summer, it was wonderful. We actually were able to celebrate the 250th anniversary of Cape Elizabeth, and we performed at an event called Night at the Light, right by the headlight, celebration of their 250 years. We were just at the Yarmouth Clam Festival over the summer, and we performed at the under the Kennebunk, the Waterhouse Pavilion on Main Street.
Were you at the show at the Clam Fest?
We sure were.
It was, I think, the Mallet Brothers played.
Dave Mallet and the Mallet Brothers.
Dave Mallet, who is the patriarch of the Mallet family, and then the Mallet Brothers themselves, who have had some real success playing not only Maine, but nationally.
Yeah.
That was a great show, and the rain held off.
It sure did.
And what a beautiful. Have you ever gone to that, Deb, up in the Clam Festival?
I have not.
Oh,
no.
It was epic. It leads into the fireworks, and then it's perfectly timed. And so the PSO is playing, and then the maestro, you know, revs up. And what's the piece that's done leading into the fireworks every year? Whatever.
Oh, the 1812 over here.
Yes.
We did that on the Eastern Promenade. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Very, very classic.
Yeah. But I think, you know, that opportunity to be able to play for large groups of people outdoors in the summer, that's been really incredible. And it's something that we want to continue doing. I think we reached probably about 70,000, maybe even more people last summer.
Wow.
Outdoor concerts. So.
Well, Carolyn, can I give you a music quiz?
Sure.
Oh, boy.
See?
My grandsons brought this up. What is the name of this song? And they sang it, and they're like, da 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 da. And I have no idea.
It's For Elise by Beethoven.
Okay. So I'm going to go home, and I'm going to look like the educated grandkid.
Yeah, and make sure you play that audio for them, too, when grandma sang Beethoven, because they don't want to miss that.
You bet.
That's
thank you.
A couple quick questions in the last few minutes we have, Carolyn. You mentioned a lot of Beethoven, and it feels like in the realm of classical music that most, if not all, of kind of the popular and well-known pieces are from hundreds of years ago. Mm. And what is that, you know, you know, like who would the top three composers be that the orchestra would play? Beethoven would be at the top of the list, right?
Yep.
And then
Beethoven, Brahms, Tchaikovsky.
Right. Bach. So all those Bach, Tchaikovsky, hundreds of years ago, before technology, before digital recording, a couple things. One, it feels like a male-dominated field in terms of at least the early classics. Yep. And can you speak to that?
Yep.
And then also, what is the state of classical music that there's no longer a Beethoven or Bach? Is there somebody somewhere producing music and arrangements that is equal in caliber and they just haven't been noticed or commercialized to Bach and Beethoven, or are we just destined hundreds of years from now to just have Beethoven and Bach and there will be no other music coming in 2015?
Yeah. First of all, just looking back at kind of those masters, they clearly were able to hit on something that is so resonates emotionally.
Timeless.
It's timeless. And I think that because they are such masterpieces, because they resonate with so many people, because they hit on an emotional level, that artistry keeps it relevant.
Right.
But I will say there are many composers now that are composing at a very high level. A couple that come to mind that have had real stay power, John Adams, John Corigliano. But as you mentioned, both of those are also gentlemen. And more and more, there is a wave to promote both female composers and conductors, because it is also a male-dominated conducting field. But we actually, in a concert that we're going to be performing on November 22nd, we're featuring a piece by a woman, Cynthia Wong, and she is going to be coming and visiting with the Portland Symphony. She's going to be speaking to our audience members.
Oh, great.
And her piece is called Carnival Fever. We were actually connected to her through our principal violist, Lori Kennedy. She said that she had heard a work of hers and connected us to Cynthia. So there are many new works that are being created more and more by women.
How about members? Out of the 83 members in the PSO, You may not know the exact breakdown, sure. But what approximately is the breakdown relative to men and women playing in the orchestra?
I don't know off the top of my head, but interestingly enough, if you read one of Malcolm Gladwell's books, he speaks about the screen process for auditions. And I think it was maybe in Vienna for many years, many of these old European orchestras were very much male dominated. And when they put the screen up,
it changed.
It changed and was nearly 50-50.
That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. So I would say there's a fairly even breakdown within our orchestra. I haven't taken a look at the actual numbers, sure. But many women, many men.
Another question I have is you mentioned about the work that's done with the PSO and with yourself personally and your background relative to music and education. Mm-hmm. And in the last couple of decades, as budgets have gotten tighter in school systems, it feels like electives and curriculum relative to the arts, whether it is music or if other areas of literally art, as well as music, that those things have been dropped in the school systems. And there are some places where they have picked it up a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, in Yarmouth, Ben Burbeck runs a studio, which is great. There's also a place, 317, sure. and other communities they have. But with your background, your passion for music growing up, and what's your thought? I believe music is critical, not just in terms of the artistic enjoyment, but in terms of what it means to kind of the human soul. It's something really powerful. But relative to education, where do we go wrong with public policy in the arts, and what can we do to be more aware and maybe change the tide a little bit and have music and other arts appreciated more?
Yeah, well, first of all, from a personal standpoint, I will say I would not be sitting here right now if it were not for a very strong public school arts focus. That program not only taught me how to play the violin, it taught me how to work with others. It taught me how to communicate well non-verbally. It taught me to be patient and to collaborate. And I think that those are the areas, if public schools are not accepting just of the fact that art for art's sake is enough, let's take a look at the other ways in which art and music can achieve something. And that's something that we have really focused on. We are right now working in the Reike Community School in Portland's West End. We have two violinists from the Portland Symphony, Amy Sims and Julia Hunter, and they and our administration, the Reike, the teachers, the music teacher, their principals, we've all been working together to figure out how we can take a look at their struggles with literacy. There are a number of students that are coming into the school each year that are not their English language learners. So they are not, English is not their first language.
Right.
And that can be very challenging. And what we're finding is music, it has these properties that when paired with what they're trying to teach can be very helpful. So if you think about how you learned the ABCs, you learned the ABCs because you paired it with music. And by pairing what they are teaching with music, these students are catching on much more quickly. It's giving them an additional context. And those are the areas then, if there are concerns about budget cuts or dropping programs, these are the types of things that we can look to say, actually, if you are cutting music programs and arts programs, you're cutting out a core competency that helps these students across the board. And like you say, there's a kind of human soul component to music as well that when I think about my time in high school, running from class to class, trying to get my homework done, to be able to come to that orchestra room and sit down with my peers and create something together,
right.
Not just trying to do my homework and get that A, but create something beautiful and meaningful together, that's something that adults hope to do in their daily lives. And that's something that I was trained to do in school.
Interesting. We have Carolyn Nishon here. The executive director, Portland Symphony Orchestra. Yeah, I can't articulate it, but there is something about music that is intrinsic to the human condition. And I think back, there was a movie a long time ago, Close Encounters or something, and they used music as the medium to reach out into the galaxy.
Yep.
Because there was something about, it was explained, something about the progression and something about the organized progression of sounds and music, and then it was tied into light, and it was that famous song.
Yep.
But there's something about it that's universal, whether it's on this planet or without getting hokey, you know, wherever. And it feels everyone, regardless of what type of music you like, and if you look behind me, I have a drape that iTunes has this album art thing where our creative department here downloaded the artwork from my iTunes. And I don't have a lot of classical, but I've got the Fleetwood Mac, the Simon and Garfunkel. I've got Beatles. I've got
classic rock.
Bruce Springsteen. But there's something about virtually everyone can look back in how music has either been the score of an experience in their life or has played a role. And it's also part of ritual when we get married. Yeah. It's ritual in most religions that music plays some sort of role. So there's something powerful about it.
Yeah.
How do you think, you know, and as you are a classically trained musician yourself before getting involved in the kind of the oversight of the business of the Portland Symphony Orchestra, how do you think classical music is faring in contemporary culture?
Mm-hmm.
And there are different periods, obviously, where people may be either more in tune to it as entertainment, but it always seems like there's a small segment that kind of gets it and likes it and enjoys it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we refer to them as the higher arts, but whether it's ballet or whether it's opera or whether it's symphony orchestra, it's a small segment. And do you think that it's destined to always be kind of part of the subculture of music, or is there a way to open it up to more people to really appreciate it?
Yeah, this is something that we have been thinking about a lot. We have thought about it. I mentioned the Discovery series where we're bringing in young kids and their parents and their grandparents to come experience this. In that way, it becomes the circle becomes widened. Similarly, we've started a program called Symphony in Spirits where 21 to 39-year-olds, they experience the concert together. So we've been selling these. We have three more that are happening this year, one that's coming up. And it's an opportunity, very low barrier, $20. You get to hear a concert, and then afterwards you go with about the 50 or 60, 21 to 39-year-olds that experience the concert with you, and you go to a local bar or pub that has been determined, and you get a free drink with that $20 ticket. And it provides an opportunity to not only experience something together, but then to have the opportunity to sit and have a drink and talk about it. So I think that by creating these opportunities, by lowering the barrier, and by just saying, you know, it doesn't matter if you know about the history of classical music or not. It's really about when you sit in the auditorium and you listen, what do you feel? What does it mean to you? You mentioned, you know, that it for many people, music is at any given point, they associate a certain piece with a soundtrack to their lives. And music makes us feel things. It makes us feel different things depending on where we are that day, what happened yesterday, what we're looking forward to. And I would just hope that people would come into the hall with that open mind of, I'm just going to let this sound wash over me. And it doesn't matter if I know what year Beethoven was born or not. I can talk about that with my mom or my grandpa or my friend who I just met and sat next to for the first time. We're going to grab a drink and talk about it.
Final question is, we're running out of time. We have Executive Director of the Portland Symphony Orchestra, Carolyn Nishon, here. This has been so interesting. I really appreciate you taking the time to come in.
Absolutely.
And wish you and the entire orchestra much success. I know this is a big season with all the great work that you're doing between now and the end of the year. And I think it's a real asset to Portland and to Maine to have such artistry in the form of music. And wish you nothing but best of luck.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to be here. And we feel very lucky to bring 83 incredible musicians and our music director, Robert, to all of you, and really think about in all of our programs, how can we truly enrich people's lives through music?
Well said. That's Carolyn Nishon. She's the Executive Director of Portland Symphony Orchestra. For any other information, please go to their website, portlandsymphony.org, or their Facebook, which is facebook.com/Portland Symphony, or they're active on Twitter. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. We'll be back next week. Thank you.